Hey everyone, it's Lauren. Over the past few months, we've seen civil unrest across the country and a renewed uprising for Black lives and the fight to hold police accountable. But we should not forget the painters, poets, musicians, and more who have decided that through their art, they can motivate people to move into action. Which is why we are sharing the story of Javen Solomon, an artist who decided to use art to bring light in the midst of destruction. After the killing of George Floyd, protests ensued across the country, and Javen's friend Tyson Baker lived right in the heart of downtown St. Louis, where protests erupted.
So as Tyson witnessed a bunch of that, he somehow connected to the owner of Bella's, a frozen yogurt shop that had their windows smashed in the process, unfortunately. He was in contact with the owner about someone like potentially getting an artist to come down and paint it. And one thing led to another, and Tyson and I basically started this thought of what if we could use this moment to gather donations for various artists to paint up these windows, to pay for their materials as well as their skills. And this is, you know, we had no dollar amount in mind. It was just, you know, we'll do what we can. Hopefully we have a lot of involvement, and if not, you know, that's fine too. So I painted Bella's initially to sort of jumpstart the whole thing, and it took off from there. We put out a call for artists for all types of boards, and it was essentially first come, first serve.
And so with the sudden decision to move into action, Javen and Tyson founded Painted Black STL, a group that empowers Black local artists by connecting and collaborating with community organizations.
For the first mural we did at Bella's, you know, this all basically transpired in a day. So since I've painted a couple of murals sort of earlier in the year, I had some paint and supplies like that laying around at home and just got straight to it. It was close to free to get it going, actually. And we didn't start spending money until, and, you know, I say spending money, and by that I mean providing, helping connect artists to some funds until the second window, when we were able to successfully demonstrate what our intent with this was. So we operated pretty cheaply and still do.
But funding local artists can be difficult. And Javen says, oftentimes artists have to choose between their art and financial stability.
First and foremost, the highest form of support comes in, you know, the form of the dollar to any degree. And I mean, and this is to say, like, what's going to incentivize, and speaking on my personal experience, right? So what's going to incentivize Black artists to like continue to strive and, you know, do the best that they can and not have to, you know, create with the strain of, you know, this type of boundary. And by this type of boundary, I mean, you know, that is of their livelihood. So if they can like create in at least semi-free way without having to shirk on their own craft and skill and time because they have other, you know, basically the mindset in a lot of ways for me anyway has been like, I can't do this. I gotta do this, this and that so I can pay this bill. You know, so if we can really properly, you know, assign a contributing dollars, our dollars into Black artists, I think that would be a huge thing.
Over the years, he's seen artists get taken advantage of, with many consumers expecting the artist's work to be free or at very low prices, which is why Painted Black STL focuses on supporting the artist fully.
You know, our main focus is making sure that the artists we work with are set, like, financially and, you know, if it comes to it, content-wise, to an extent. And we don't give them any creative bounds because that's not our job. You know, the artist is an artist for a reason, right? So we didn't find there to be any need to hop into that and try to be, you know, a gatekeeping whatever. We're more focused on like, all right, how can we get these artists paid so they can really be the best folks they can be? And maybe they can even pay it forward. And we all start to understand the value of our community as Black artists and, you know, ultimately artists as a whole.
And when you support an artist fully, their work is able to reach a wider audience and inspire as many people as possible.
Art is, and this relates to any style or medium or means of delivery, right? So not just visual art per se. Art is always, has always been that thing that honestly, like, drives a lot about us, and we don't even realize it, you know? So we, you know, obviously we're moved, you know, or inspired when we go to museums here in St. Louis or elsewhere, but there's a reason that, you know, when you go to a protest, you're going to see a ton of folks with signs and with different, you know, things that folks want to express, is because at a basic level, that's honestly, I think, how we communicate. It is how we convey what we want people to understand from us, as well as, you know, inverse, like it's how we receive information.
Art's ability to convey a message has been around for a long time, and Javen uses the iconographic example of the Black Fist, which rose to prominence in the 1960s, to show how much art can be used as a platform for social change.
These things have zero words, you know, in terms of face value attached to them, but it means, all these different symbols mean so much to us. So art is his, it's always kind of been that way, and I think now it's particularly relevant. Because, you know, we're back at a point where, I mean, fundamentals, where we are addressing fundamentals. And I believe that, you know, the art, any artistic medium or form is part of our basic, like, set of fundamental skills and means of communicating.
Iconographic examples like the Black Fist are just one way to show the importance of documentation and how artists from the past were able to capture a moment in time.
The beauty, I think, with art specifically is that it can be received in so many ways just from an image. So the old phrase, a picture is worth a thousand words, a lot of these things really are, and, you know, deserve to be cared for, because, I mean, this is our livelihood that's being documented down, and how things have shifted. So it's most important to refer to these things as well as document them to serve as a visual or otherwise memento of, you know, how life was lived, is lived, and could be lived. I think of James Baldwin as a specific case. What, you know, he might not have formally been, and forgive me if I'm wrong, but he might have formally been a historian, but his work encapsulates the times he was living in and was able to, you know, express what was going on, and, you know, as well as himself. These are important to us because, I mean, these are, it's another means of documentation and for us to understand sort of where we've been and with hope where not to go.
Learning from past work can help artists reinvent themselves, and Javen believes that St. Louis artists have always been unique and different in their approach.
St. Louis's culture, and just like a lot of folks that come from here in general, have just been like really influential to a lot of things, and they contribute a lot more than folks prefer to either give credit for or look into or, you know, whatever else. And this is something that I've even learned up until now and over the last, my whole life, basically. So I think what makes us that way is our location, in that, you know, we are in an unfortunate position to, you know, I feel like a lot of us feel like we got to chase after, you know, the big city thing, or a lot of us have felt that way, and a lot of us have left for it. But, you know, these days I see folks who are saying, myself included, you know, we don't need to necessarily chase after that, because I think a lot of that is, I don't know, I think we're starting to form our own identity in that, like, we can do a lot of good stuff here and still, like, take a little bit of, take a couple of cues from, like, other cities, but, like, we're sort of forced to become our own thing, I think, in a lot of ways.
One example of a St. Louisan creating their own unique style is Nelly, a hip-hop artist who rose to fame in the early 2000s. His debut album, Country Grammar, was certified diamond in 2016 by the Recording Industry Association of America for selling 10 million units. And more recently, Nelly performed at the 2020 American Music Awards to celebrate the 20th anniversary of Country Grammar's release, showing the world just how much his Midwest style changed the rap game.
I mean, barring a group or two before him, was essentially the main one doing things in his style. Like, we're forced to be inventive here in a lot of ways, because I think we've got that small big city syndrome where we know there's folks bigger than us, but like, if you talk about us in any sort of way, it's you in trouble. We're forming our own like consensus and identity, I think, as we speak. And that's why, you know, with Painted Black, for example, we have so many, there's so many different styles represented that are like, I think, a product of a lot of us just sort of fostering our own thing. And now that things are starting to come together, I think there'll be a lot more of that like unique style and voice to come.
Painted Black STL is just one part of the movement inspiring the younger generation of artists. And for Javen, the advice he got from his mentor, Antoinette Carroll, the president and CEO of Creative Reaction Lab, to fail often and fail quickly, still rings true today.
Specifically in St. Louis, if this is a city of, we don't quite realize it in a lot of times, in a lot of ways, but St. Louis is a city of ample opportunity in that it is a, also citing Antoinette, it is a very cheap place to fail, for now anyway, in that, you know, if you want to start a project and it doesn't work out, cost of living isn't that high and things aren't too expensive here in general, you know, comparatively speaking, especially to other cities. So this is a great place to get started. But in general, yeah, I would say, you know, just hop right in, fail often and fail quickly, just because it's a field that's even still being formed a little bit more like as we speak. So there's not necessarily, you know, one way in particular or, you know, others to get started, but it's a matter of, you know, it's really a function of you loving what it is that you're getting into and communicating with folks. And honestly, like, reach out to folks. It doesn't matter who it is, because you never know, you know, what could happen. And by that, I mean, reach out to folks who, you know, you either want to learn more from, have a conversation with, collaborate with, etc. And, you know, be clear with your intentions, be super clear with your intentions and as transparent as possible. You know, be sure to take in all types of points of view, so that you have a better understanding for what it is you're doing and, you know, essentially yourself as a person, because that learning as much as you can and interacting with all types of folks is how you, you know, really start to root yourself in what it is you want to do and work towards, I think. I'll always make it clear with other folks as well as yourself that you are not better than anyone you think you are serving or around. Something to always remember is that we work with people, right? No one works for us. We're not above anyone else, because we're all humans at the end of the day. And that's the basis of, you know, social justice and design for good and, you know, equity and inclusion work, is that we are all at the same level as humans. So just, you know, keep that in mind, because a lot of folks sort of lose sight of that as they gain a little bit more popularity, or just, you know, in general, right? And folks get jaded and things change, and now you're off base with, you're way off base from what it is that got you into this work.
Painted Black STL sprung out of a moment of discourse and pain to bring something beautiful to the forefront. And the one thing that is motivating Javen is connecting others and creating spaces for people to thrive.
There is a lot of promise in this year. You know, unfortunately, it is paired with, you know, a lot of tragedy and dismay and pain, physically, emotionally, spiritually. But I see in a realm where so many folks are trying to communicate so many things, it's clear to me that folks want to see something different. And I also believe that there is, I think a lot, with a background in design and just like a general passion for, you know, the design process and just being a curious and cynical person at the same time, unfortunately, but I'm able to see that, you know, we essentially live in these designed entities, spaces, structures, et cetera. And anything that's designed can be redesigned. It happens every day, you know, whether we realize it or not. So I'm inspired by how many folks, whether they directly say what I just said or not, realize, you know, are coming to realize just that. And they're, you know, collaborating with each other. There's a lot of work that's stemming from this because to paraphrase it, because people feel a way about some things, you know, a lot of us are coming together over it and we are being the change that we want to see. Through high school, I played sports and there was some sort of almost sort of masochistic unity. You know, I'll use track as an example. Like, we all hate running this set of laps in practice, but we know that if we continue to do this together, it's going to make us better because we're all working towards this goal of being better and getting better. So I will see that it's a balancing act for sure, because it's not, you know, not every day is so inspiring and upbeat, but you know, it's in the ebb and flow, you know, moving forward metaphorically is what's helping me, you know, move forward, no pun intended, I suppose.
Painted Black STL isn't the only group fostering Black artists in the community. Others have been around for years and continue to fight the good fight today. So in this episode, we'll hear from the founder of Art House about building a place for artists of color to thrive in their own community. And the founder of Herb Arts will teach us about art's ability to uncover systemic racism and how we can create a marketplace to support Black artists in a more meaningful way. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here. The tragic killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and more move people into action even during a pandemic. But we know that St. Louis has its own history of systemic racism, from the East St. Louis riots to Dred Scott, and more notably in recent years, the Ferguson Rebellion in 2014 after the killing of Michael Brown Jr. The Ferguson Rebellion moved many activists into action, inspiring them to create organizations and groups to combat systems of oppression in the St. Louis region. One of those activists is Elizabeth Vega, the co-founder of Artivist STL, a group of activists who focus on art-based actions, and the founder of Art House, an affordable housing cooperative for activists.
So Art House sprang directly from the Ferguson Rebellion. We literally looked at the house, or got the listing for the house on the one-year anniversary of Mike Brown's death, and purchased the house with a idea and vision that it would be a movement home, a place where activists and artists could live and do the work that they felt called to do and still have affordable living. And also a place where we could organize and do movement work. I used $5,000 from a student loan because, fun fact, if you are particularly if you're in grad school, you can use student loans for housing. And instead of renting a house, I decided to use student loan money to put a down payment on the house, and we paid it off in 3 years. You know, we have very, very modest living expenses, and that frees us up to do the work that we're called to do. Like, we just did food share in our backyard. So it's a really beautiful space.
Our house is located in the mostly Black area of North City in St. Louis, with a 45% poverty rate. And Elizabeth says it's important to build places in the areas that need them the most.
Part of why we chose this neighborhood was because, you know, it's where a lot of the work is in terms of the police presence on the north side, in terms of poverty, in terms of political education, all of that. And instead of parachuting into a neighborhood, the goal was to set a place where we could work in collaboration with people in the community, as opposed to just kind of parachuting and coming in. And by living here, it connects our fates together. During the Ferguson Rebellion, we became very aware about the power of art, the power of art to provoke, to heal, to, process. And so that's how the Artivist got founded. And through that, we started creating a large body of work and recognizing that, you know, you always want those who are most directly impacted to be the ones who are in the forefront. And that the same goes for art. And so a lot of what has been happening recently is that the artivists in particular have moved from not just creating protest art and things like that, but to also cultivating art within BIPOC communities. The art world is steeped in racism, just like the rest of the world. Oftentimes, young BIPOC artists don't have an opportunity to do the work that they want to do because of racism, because of access, because of, you know, sometimes art can be expensive. And so how do you gain that if you have a natural artistic ability, but there's these barriers?
Systemic racism spans across all areas of life for people of color. And those barriers are why it's so important to have places like Art House, which gives people an outlet to create and understand the struggles they face on a daily basis. And for Elizabeth, the time she spent working in different art communities is how she learned the true power of art.
I got involved in the regional arts community art program, which taught artists and social workers of all kinds, you know, community workers, how to use art within community spaces. And that was long before the movement that I was doing things like that. I was teaching poetry and all of that. Feeling that community art is really important. When the Ferguson Rebellion happened, one of the first things that was kind of instrumental was the very first day of the protest. There was a child that was in the front line of the protest, and he looked like he was about 4, but he was actually 3, and he had this very shocked look on his face. And I got down on my hands and knees and I asked him, I was like, baby, are you okay? Because I'm a grandmother. And he said, you know, they shot Mike, and I saw him dead in the street. And it's like, what do you say? This child bore witness to this, you know? And so all I had was Sharpie and paper, and we made a protest sign together, and we talked big words like justice. And I remember his sister spelling it with the backwards J and, you know, this protest sign. And that started Art in Canfield, where we would go and do pop-up art spaces, catty corner from where Mike Brown was killed. And it was so amazing. All we did was hold space. We had art supplies and people would come and they would pour their thoughts into it. Kids would come and make buttons. I had a little girl that made a button one time that said, I don't trust the police. And you know me, at the time I was still in my very liberal, not quite radical phase. And I was like, oh, well, you know, not all police are bad. And she looked at me point blank, this child of about 9 or 10. And she's like, yeah, how will I know the difference? And I was like, you know what? She's right. And we started making these buttons together. That's the power of art. A small piece of paper that somebody could say something that they've been thinking and have voice with that. You know, and and have an outlet for all the complex feelings that are in there. So that's the healing power of art.
The power art has to heal is one of the reasons why it is so important to document the movement for future change makers who will be able to look back at history and use that to make a better society for all.
People are asking, you know, what do you think about Joe Biden? And I don't think the politics are going to save us. I think that we have to start trying to really cultivate change. And artists, because of the way they think, because of the way that they process, are key to sort of helping shape and cultivate that vision. When you also think about particularly murals on a large scale, how artwork can shape narratives. And so if you have Black, Brown, and Indigenous folks shaping a social justice narrative in their own neighborhoods, ultimately that changes the culture around them and introduces images and language that get people talking so that when we do start to bring it up in social justice, like in protests and in demands, it doesn't seem so different or unusual. People have already been acclimated to the language and I can begin to understand what it means. So it's extremely important. I think that the artists have always led transformative movements. And I think that it is because of the process that we go through to create. It's the same, whether it's on canvas or it's in your neighborhood. I mean, I think that it's a different history that art can present. While art is a reflective of the culture very often, it is also, it kind of is a seer of culture. It can predict culture. It can shape it. It can change it. And so, you know, one of the things that I really, really loved when we were doing protest art, particularly during the Ferguson Rebellion and, you know, other things, was that the mom said that when children were confused about what was going, they could always point to the art and use that as a pathway for deeper exploration and explanation. And so I think that that's why it's important. And it's not just visual arts. It's music and dance and poetry and all of it. And I think that the importance of art is that what it does is it's a different energy. It's a reminder of what we're fighting for rather than what we're fighting against. And to me, I think that that's a very important difference because fighting against something, it's a different energy. But when you're fighting for something, it's both resistance and creation at the same time.
One example of documenting a moment in time is the Healing Walls Project, which was funded through Washington University St. Louis's Divided Cities Initiative in partnership with Ashley Cathy and other art activists from Louisville, Kentucky, where Breonna Taylor was killed.
Basically, what it does is, and it's going to go national, it gives artists who are visual artists an opportunity to learn how to do large-scale mural work in their own neighborhoods and communities and tell their own story in their way. And the idea is that you're building skills. So it's like a Skillshare. Artists will get a stipend for their design or for helping. We're asking folks to suggest walls. And the first mural went up on Art House's sidewall where all our folks come from Food Share. And it was so beautiful to see all artists of color painting on the wall, collaborating and talking among each other. So it really is like artist development. And there's some big things coming. So watch for it because we really believe that the artists are the visionaries that are going to help us reimagine the world that we want to live in.
And with the belief that artists are the visionaries who will help us reimagine the world we want to live in, we asked Elizabeth, what advice would she give to younger artists who want to be a part of the movement?
One of the mottos of the Artivists is that we're making social justice visual. And so sort of look at what is happening and how you can use your creativity and imagination to bring that to the forefront of people's minds. When we first started, we had no idea what we were doing. There were so many things that we've learned over the past 5 years. It was just that we had skills, we had a particular point of view, and we had a lot that we wanted to say. And my advice to young artists would be to just start doing it, you know, and trust that there will be an evolution of both your creativity, your imagination, and your radical consciousness.
Being a part of the struggle can take a toll on you, but what's motivating Elizabeth to continue the work is the vision of a better world.
I'm just real honest about the fact that not this past summer, but summer before, I was in a really bad mental health space. 6 years of protesting, not just in Ferguson, but on the border and in Memphis, and, you know, had really started to take a mental health toll. And I wasn't doing a very good job taking care of myself. You know, self-care is really difficult when you've never, ever been really cared for. And people say self-care, that is a process of how you learn to do that. And so after being in a really like bad place, you know, where I actually had to call my best friends and be like, you know, I cannot stop thinking about killing myself. And I knew that it wasn't that I wanted to die. I just knew that I was so tired and so depleted and just, you know, I was burnt out. And so I had to take real control of that. I started meditating, which has been a very large part of my self-care practice now, because as activists, we have a tendency to either be rooted in the future or the past. Everything about it, even being on the front of the protest lines, we're not in our present physical bodies, because to be able to like be arrested and dragged and all of that, it's almost an out-of-body experience to be able to cope with that. So meditation really brings me in here and the now. It makes me feel my body, allows me to do deep ancestral healing and work that I've needed to do. It also grounds me. So that's been really instrumental. This is a long haul struggle. The urgency that we often sometimes feel, I think, is a result of white supremacy culture, because these systems of oppression have been around for a very, very long time. So they are going to take time to dismantle. So we have to do the struggle in such a way that it's sustainable. And for me, part of that is that even in our resistance, there's joy. Even in our resistance, there's the sacred. Even in our resistance, there is whimsy. I say that I don't want to do creative direct actions anymore that don't make me laugh or don't make me cry. Because I think that that's what we need. We're so numbed out by the culture that our resistance and response needs to be a really strong pull and counterpoint to it, so that people can't help themselves but join. Because within there, they find the world that we want to create in the now, even in our resistance.
So what can we do to support artists of color in a more meaningful way? And how can we create spaces where artists are valued and able to live their lives without diminishing their creativity? Up next, we'll hear from M.K. Stallings, the founder of the Urban Arts Alliance for Child Development, or Urb Arts, about art's connection to social justice and building a marketplace for Black artists to support themselves. The Urban Alliance for Child Development, or Urb Arts, is a nonprofit that follows in the tradition of the Black arts movement of the 1960s and 70s by honoring Black aesthetics that speak to the Black experience. Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, they haven't been hosting in-person art exhibitions. Under new restrictions in St. Louis City that allow for a max of 10 people with masks and 6 feet apart for social distancing requirements, they opened their doors for Due Process Denied, an art exhibition that confronts police brutality in our community, which I attended on November 20th, its opening night. I was able to speak to Billy Bill Williams, one of the exhibition coordinators, about the importance of art during this time.
It's a definite reflection on the things we kind of went through, especially this year. It's been so traumatic. And I think it's a way to kind of reflect on that, talk about it. It's also allows us to kind of heal, too. It's a healing mechanism. I know it is for me as an artist, but I mean, just to kind of capture the beauty of the struggle in a sense.
The art exhibition comes after Herb Arts founder M.K. Stallings decided to reassess how to serve Black artists and support the community after the death of George Floyd. This reassessment led to the creation of three initiatives. First, Create Pressure, using art exhibition to hold law enforcement accountable for their misconduct against the Black community. Second, Inform Our Community, informing the community on the policy position and history of elected officials on issues important to them. And third, Register Voters and Turnout. For MK, these three initiatives put pressure on those in power to make a change, because the mistreatment of Black folks by police goes back decades.
Unfortunately, I don't think law enforcement in the United States has ever really reckoned with its racist past, its racist origins. And if you never take time and look at how you've contributed to the systematic forms of racism, these hate crime-esque looking situations where essentially Black citizens are lynched and denied due process, that's an opportunity lost. And so this particular initiative, or these three things that we're doing, is just about trying to hold, or joining in, a community of people who want to hold law enforcement accountable for their behavior.
And to help us understand the history of police misconduct and its effects, MK refers back to the Ferguson Rebellion in 2014 and how it sparked a new way of thinking.
When we opened up our gallery in 2014, it was just a few months before Michael Brown Jr. was killed by Darren Wilson. At that time, St. Louis began to shift and think about how, like, different parts of St. Louis, thinking about how they've either contributed to the climate that was set off in Ferguson, or they began to think about ways of supporting the effort. For us, because, you know, we were Black before the murder and Black after the murder, the real question is, how do we ensure that we're safe? How do we honor the lives of those who've passed and who were taken away? How do we, as Black artists, confront those problems that seem to besiege our community, that seem to hurt our community annually, monthly, or daily? And, you know, it's ill, because we got so many problems in St. Louis, particularly around gun violence. And it can happen within the Black community, where you might have a Black person who's a perpetrator of a crime, and they may use a gun to hurt another Black person. So you have that. The last thing we need is for law enforcement to continue to do the things it used to do as slave patrols. We don't need that added burden, right? So as artists, it's our job to complicate the simplistic and to simplify the complicated, to get us to see things in different ways so we can better appreciate the weight of these matters, the weight of this stuff.
Because art has a way of addressing complex issues, we wanted to know just how much people can gain from art in times like these.
what art does is humanize. It gets us to think clearly about individuals and their experiences. Also, like I said, art can help illustrate how things operate on a systemic basis. It's very difficult to see systemic racism. That's not something that people are trained to see. I mean, to a certain degree, you need to have a background in social science. You need to have an ability to be able to connect the dots between independent variables and dependent variables. You have to follow and appreciate the nuance of policy and how policy might be, public policy that is, how public policy might be interpreted and executed for the general public. That's a lot to think about. And if people aren't really trained to do all that, I can see why they miss it, why they only fall to, you know, if somebody uses the N-word or if a white person does something to a black person. It's much more complicated than that. So I think what artists can do, if they understand these basic things, they can illustrate, they can show, they can capture a moment. And that moment may resonate where you feel where this artist was trying to go. That's the phenomenological nature of art, where you experience the art in a very deep way that could be moving for you. And the goal is, if you can move enough people who can experience something at a deep level, then that might move them to action.
And sometimes you may not realize that you are experiencing art. For example, video recordings or film is a visual art form, and we know that video recordings of police brutality go back to the 1991 brutal beating of Rodney King in Los Angeles, and even before that.
I'll say one thing about what happened with George Floyd and how his murder was captured on video. It took a platform such as film or video, something that's accessible to people, and used that moment, and because we've seen things on TV, we've seen things online, we can understand the drama and the moment. If you match that to the audio, it's even more dramatic, it's even more concerning or disconcerting. It's even more of a problem. People feel it because they can see it. And that's also because of how we might consume media. If we consume media such as film and television on a regular basis, to see that, it makes it clear that something horrific is happening and we're bearing witness to it in a way that we can't unsee it once it's done. And so even though the person who held the camera so that the world could bear witness to what the officer was doing to George Floyd, even though that happened, and when that happened, it allowed us to almost be present, to almost feel just as helpless as I imagine everybody else did as they watched law enforcement take somebody's life. That's stirring. That's powerful. And I think if art can do a job of illustrating the power in those moments, the helplessness in those moments, how we cry out, how we move, how we act, how we, you know, drop our heads in despair or lift our eyes in hope. Art has the opportunity of creating this moment where we can experience things in a far deeper level than just reading a news report.
The power of art to inform is the reason why MK believes Black artists need to be supported more financially for their creativity, boldness, and tenacity. But there are structural barriers in the way of that reality.
In St. Louis, we have a lot of arts organizations, arts institutions. They support art in various ways. What St. Louis is missing is a viable market for Black artists, meaning that unless you are, I'm just going to speak strictly from like creating art such as portraiture, you know, paintings and such. You know, so there's a market, you know, for art. And some people are able to tap into that market. They know people who are collectors, they know people who have money, and these things manifest in ways that allow for artists to make a sizable amount of money. So you'll have somebody on the north side who might make $100 off of a painting. You'll have somebody in Webster Groves or Kirkwood that makes $10,000 off of a painting. And if even if the artist is selling that painting out of his or her own trunk, they are getting the full $100, and that's great. If the artist that's selling in Webster Groves is splitting a percentage with the gallerist may be retaining 40%. So that would be $4,000 of a $10,000 painting. The artist makes $6,000. Either scenario, both scenarios, the artist can get paid, but obviously in the Webster Groves scenario, the artist is getting paid so much more. Why are there such deep differences? It all depends on, you know, who a person knows. And unfortunately, who a person knows has its roots in the kind of residential segregation that we've experienced in St. Louis, the sort of networks-based segregation that we've experienced in St. Louis, where you gotta get to know certain people, they have to become your friends, you gotta build that up, and then all of a sudden you have some potential buyers for artists. All that's possible. You know, it just depends on whether or not you're willing to play that game. And that game being getting to know people who don't necessarily like what you like, or you don't necessarily like what they like, but you're doing it because it's really for transactional purposes. That's a really limited way or limited reason to get to know somebody, just so that you know they have money so they can give to your operation. But that's a part of the game, you know, whether we're talking about nonprofit stuff or just trying to court, you know, buyers or collectors, that's a part of the game, getting to know people.
There are so many barriers that Black artists have to overcome in order to succeed. But what keeps MK motivated to help the generation coming after him are the reasons why he fell in love with art in the first place and the artists who came before him.
The first time I experienced art, at least the kind of art that I would be a practitioner of and participant in, is when I first heard a rapper that I liked. I heard LL Cool J do I'm Bad. I was about 7 years old. I tried to freestyle like him. I'm pretty sure I was not successful, but then again, I don't remember. So I was freestyling. And from there, you know, I would write some poems. I always saw myself as a writer, you know, and so I wanted to just write. And I would be introduced to different kinds of writers, different kinds of poets along the way. But I think when it got deep for me was after high school, a friend had introduced me to the work of The Last Poets. The Last Poets put out an album called The Last Poets, and it had some just seminal classics on their project, some of which I can't even say the names because it's impolite or profane in some kinds, in ways. So, but you know, but their work, which predates the kind of profane realness that you would hear in hip hop, of the likes that, you know, LL Cool J or Public Enemy or KRS-One or others would be able to speak to. They would just be able to speak to things that were just raw with only their voices and a djembe drum, you know? And that was powerful. That was powerful to know that that kind of thing can be created and can have a lasting impact. Amiri Baraka kind of serves as the institutional visionary that makes sense to me, as well as the work of Hakeem Madhubuti out of Chicago, where they were able to set up structures where they would not only benefit as artists and as creatives, but also were able to create opportunities for other people to be paid, you know, to create poetry classes or to publish books, if we're talking about Third World Press and with Haki. Those are the kinds of role models that I appreciate deeply because they risked a lot. You know, they didn't have to do it and they did it and they got some name recognition from it, but they also got a lot of, I'm sure, a lot of stress, a lot of sleepless nights, a lot of discouragement, but that's what's necessary. If you want to build something that can be a benefit to the community as well as to the individuals that you seek to serve, then you absolutely have to create something that's bigger than you, that can outlast you if you set it up properly. And so that's what I'm interested in doing. I'm interested in creating something that will be institutional, that will outlast me and my time with it. I want something that will benefit the children to come as they become adults, and the children to come after that as they are still children, and bring these generations of people together, these generations of elders, of people who are in their 20s, 30s, or even 40s, people who are in their teens, people who are in primary school, to be able to bring these different generations of people together around art making and truth. Because that's how you build community. That's how you reveal deep truths that are, that words can't really adequately explain where things are coming from, or why certain things are. So you need art to be able to paint that picture, whether it's beautiful words or beautiful paintings. You need that. And the best way to protect it is by having an institution to back it, to be able to house a program like that inside of an institution. And it can't be a white-led institution, because they oftentimes water down or act skittish around things they can't speak to. They oftentimes make difficult decisions that are sometimes the wrong decisions. So you have to have people who are immersed in the culture, who are respectful of the culture, who will bring in individuals who can speak adequately to the truths within that culture, and who will fiercely protect what's happening, you know? And not to say that a white-led, you know, art museum or a white-led history museum can't do that kind of work. I'm just dubious as to whether or not they could do it successfully. If they could do it with tact, if they could do it with grace, if they can do it with community, I don't know. I just know that for me, when I do the work that I do, I'm me. I have conversations with artists who can, build with us, and we build together and hopefully create a moment that can be transformative or informative for some people.
And it's his connection to his community of artists that inspires MK to keep creating experiences that shift culture, that is carrying him through this time.
Inertia. I mean, when you do work, it helps to create more work, and it helps to push you forward and push me forward. So it's kind of just like physics. Because I'm in motion already, I can stay in motion. And then one job ends, another job begins. So you just stay in motion. There's another activity that you have to do. Also, I'm a father. I have two young boys, with a third child on the way. What's interesting is you gotta keep moving, like, just for them, not to be a role model, but because they expect activity. They expect you to be present. And so you have to be. So part of it is obligation. Like, I have things that I need to do, and I have reasons why I need to do them. So that's part of what keeps me motivated. In terms of being a creative, I'm always creating, whether it's for an audience or just for myself, whether I'm like freestyling something whack, or even maybe something surprisingly good. And I think every artist is in the business of creating impressions. They're in the business of creating experiences and memories, and how individuals curate those memories, how they kind of sort those memories, are up to them. But if we do something that's impactful, that's powerful, then they'll always have that memory present. Then the individual can always go back and relive a portion of that moment. And so that's what we want to do. We want them to be able to live in these moments. And the more of these moments that we can live in that promote justice and promote liberation, that can promote fairness, equity, equality. We're talking about opportunities to really socialize or re-socialize folks into thinking differently about the worlds they inhabit and the spaces they indwell. And that's what matters to me. And as a creative, that becomes part of what pushes me forward in addition to, you know, inertia.
This show is produced by me, Lauren Brown, and lead producer Jolianne Yang. You can visit the Art House St. Louis Facebook page to view the murals from the Healing Walls Project. And if you're in St. Louis, you can visit the murals at 3911 Greer Avenue, 63107, where Art House also hosts food shares every Wednesday and every other Sunday at 11:30 a.m. And check out the visual arts exhibition, Herb Arts Presents Due Process Denied, online at herbarts.org/due-process-denied, or wear a mask and visit the show in person at Herb Arts at 2600 North 14th Street, 63106, now until January 20th. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From PRX.